Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Please consider supporting Black Women United, YEG, for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. You can learn more about them at bwunited.ca. They are always looking for donations and volunteers. So please, again, support Black Women United, YEG, for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. Again, that website is bwunited.ca.
Well, hey there, it's Zach, all the way from Chesapeake, Virginia. Creative Control happens to be my favorite podcast. I value Visha's insight and his ability to balance humor with in-depth conversation while occasionally dipping into serious topics. Regardless of whether I've heard of the guest or not, or however long Visha's known them, you really do get the feeling that the two of them have known each other for a long time, and I walk away from every episode feeling like I gained something. I think that's testament to how good of a journalist and conversationalist Visha is. He has a real skill of opening people up. I also enjoy the spicy and lighthearted ribbing Visha does with his guests from time to time. Oh, and while I have you, did you know that for just $6, you can subscribe to the Creative Control Patreon and get access to all kinds of bonus content? And for $10, Visha will mail you one of his t-shirts. And hey, that peachy shirt is pretty cool. Anyway, enjoy the episode and doot doot loot doo. Oh, wait.
Aaron Goldstein is a talented pedal steel player and electric guitarist, songwriter, singer, and producer who resides in Toronto, Ontario. Known for his work in the band Huron and frequent collaborations with Ian Blurton, Goldstein's pedal steelwork is sought after, and he's done session work or else been a touring member with the likes of Kathleen Edwards, City in Color, Daniel Romano, Cowboy Junkies, The Sadies, Tara Lightfoot, and Richard Laviolette, among many others. For his own songwriting pursuits in recent years, Goldstein started working as Espinola, whose second star-studded and spirited album, Espinola Again, was released on October 6th, 2023, via Sonic Onion Records. Just ahead of that, Aaron and I reconvened for a good talk in which he recounted the recent tour he did opening up for Willie Nelson while in Kathleen Edwards' band, how he got into playing music, but specifically the pedal steel, the history of Espinola, the admittedly blurry line between producing songs and helping someone write them, lyrical themes of displacement on Espinola Again, making Southern rock when you live in Southern Ontario, making more Espinola music, other future plans, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One Network with the support of listeners just like you who follow and subscribe to this donor-driven podcast and spread the word about it and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol. Hey, not for nothing, I've increased the perks at the $10 a month level. That's $10 American, I should say. So if you've ever wanted to donate and support my show and my work, now's the time to do it. Again, head over to patreon.com/creativecontrol, and if you can afford to do so, please support this show today. Thank you so much. Plus, in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario. All wonderful independent businesses. This is episode 823 of Creative Control, featuring the lovely and talented Aaron Goldstein from Espanola, with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Yeah, the coast is clear on halfway. I've been over the ride. I've been taking out time. I've been out of my mind. I've been giving it time. And I know I'll be fine. Hey, Aaron, how's it going?
Fine, thanks, Vish. How are you?
I'm well. It's nice to see you again. It's been a long time.
Yes, and likewise. Yeah, yeah. It's, I was trying to remember when I last saw you. You know, we tend to run into each other, I guess, at the odd festival or whatever, but it's been a while.
Yeah, it's been a long time. I don't go to as many as I used to. You still going to lots of things?
Yeah, I mean, when I can. I mean, mostly it's when I'm playing.
Yeah.
But yeah, every summer tends to be, you know, depending on who's calling, I'll end up all over the place.
Yeah, that's true. You're still kind of a hired gun in that regard.
Yeah. Doing a little less of that. I mean, it's really more production these days. And so it's sort of like I'll take the Right Road stuff that makes sense. Still working with Kathleen Edwards. That's sort of like the main road job right now.
And, I got to ask you some questions about that, because there's Willie Nelson stuff I want to ask you about, because I saw saw your post. That seemed magical. Before we get much further, I have some business I like to deal with at the beginning of every episode.
Granddads?
Namely, where? No. No, that's already been taken care of. Where in the world are you today, Aaron, is what I usually ask people.
Today I'm in Toronto at my headquarters, which I fondly refer to as Gold Standard Recorders. This is my studio where I do all my work.
Now, are you in your studio as we're speaking?
I'm in the sort of lounge area, you might say. It's another unit that is upstairs from the studio that I have as like, lounge, the kitchen and bathroom. I got an office up here and just sort of extra space. The studio itself is an amazing space, but it didn't really have anywhere to hang out, you know?
I see.
So I acquired this space as well, and it's been great.
Sorry, is this on your the property of your home?
No, this is out in the East York.
Oh, okay.
And the building itself is a former theater. It was the Donlands Theater.
Oh.
And famously, John Candy lived across the road as a child and would walk over here to see films.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. Yeah. That's amazing. I love John Candy. I love SCTV. I love all his films, basically. I'm a big fan. So that's nice to hear.
Yeah, me too. It's sort of the claim to fame of this building is that he, you know, his ghost walks the halls, you know.
Any kind of marker signifying that his house is across the street? Some sort of plaque?
No, I'm not sure. You know, to be honest, I don't know which house it is, but in the front lobby, there's sort of a history of the building, and that's one of the things that it mentions.
I see. All right. Well, that's lovely, and the place looks nice. Mm. Congratulations. That's great.
Thanks.
And you're keeping busy as a producer, it sounds like.
Yeah, I've been lucky. I mean, you know, it's work that I've done for a long time, but it was always in between tours. And I really love the work. I believe a lot in the role. And often, you know, if people are coming in and they're sort of taking my temperature and they're trying to decide whether I'm the right person, I often tell them, you know, even if I'm not the right person, it's an important role. It's a good idea to have somebody who has a different perspective on the material than you do.
Yeah.
So if you don't hire me, you should probably hire somebody. Of course, that's not, you know, there's plenty of bands that make their own records and they turn out great. It's really a project by project thing.
Sometimes it's just a crude experience, right? A musician becomes a producer after working themselves, after working with producers over the course of their working life, right?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, to be honest, the fact that I play sort of a more rare instrument, you know, pedal steel has been my thing for a long time. And since I was younger, I probably ended up on more, I ended up playing more sessions than most guitar players, for example, just because there's fewer of us.
Yes.
And so I got the opportunity to watch a lot of different producers work. And I really liked the idea of the job.
Yeah.
And I just sort of dove into it.
Sorry to interrupt you there. How did you get into pedal steel in particular? Was it because you noticed there was a scarcity of such players? And maybe you could, you know, some musicians find out that as they enter a community, wow, no one plays bass in this town. No one plays drums. So maybe I should pick that up instead of being yet another lead guitarist. Was any of that entering your mind as you picked up the pedal steel?
I'll tell you, that's how I sold it to my dad for sure. I mean, I'm an obsessive by nature, a record obsessive, as I know you probably are. And a lot of people that we fraternize with. And, I got really into, like, when I first got to university at McMaster, I got really into the early Neil Young records. And of course, Ben Keith is the steel player on those records. Yeah. And I became sort of obsessed with the sound and realized I didn't know anybody who played it. I had never even seen one in person and wasn't sure how to really even play it. This is about 2004 or 5. And so, you know, I had the internet, but the internet was still maybe in its infancy, you might say. And certainly, you know, the information about steel guitar was scarce because, you know, the masters of the instrument tend to be older people. And so in 2005, how many, you know, older people were there on the internet talking about steel guitar? It was a very sort of, information was scarce, let's put it that way. There happened to have been a forum, and the forum still exists, the Steel Guitar Forum. It was a very old school, you know, internet message board where the rule was you must use your real first and last name. And I had to send $5 in an envelope to the moderator for the server fees in order to join. And, I got on the forum and asked some questions. And, I eventually, funny enough, Longa McQuaid carried like a student model, and, I was able to acquire one. And, in the early days, I didn't know what I was doing. I played a little bit of open tuning on guitar and a little bit of sort of slide guitar and stuff. And I just kind of assumed that I'd be able to sit down at it and make my way on it. And when I first put the first one together, I was completely lost and I didn't know I almost took it back. But I was in a band with some friends from McMaster, and they really encouraged me to bring the steel to our shows. And to, you know, just play it no matter what. And it is the kind of instrument where if you learn a couple tricks, you can make very pleasing music on it quickly, but then it's a total lifetime to master. So I was able to sort of, you know, make some interesting music on it and probably stunk it up a bit in these shows. But my friends were very encouraging, and I just kept bringing it out and kept playing. I remember I had a gig with this country rock band that I was in McMaster. It was called the Surly Young Bucks. And I had a radio interview with Lou Molinaro before one of our gigs. And he said, well, you know, you're playing the pedal steel and you're playing country rock. You must be a big fan of the Flying Burrito Brothers. And I said, the what? Like I'd never heard. So I immediately dove into that, like into their catalog. And it was from there that I got into the old country stuff. Like I would have heard all those Merle Haggard songs that they cover. I heard them first. And then I heard Merle later.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, pretty much Neil Young and Ben Keith, and then the Burrito Brothers and Sneaky Pete. That was my entry into it.
I see. Yeah. Well, no, that's amazing. That's a fascinating entry point into a pretty idiosyncratic instrument among the most. We were referencing John Candy earlier. You were talking about Merle Haggard and country music. So I want to get to some Planes, Trains, and Automobiles in the fact that you recently did a tour with Kathleen Edwards and with Willie Nelson. Is that right?
That is correct. We were out for 3 weeks opening for Willie Nelson on the Outlaw tour, they call it.
My goodness. I saw the clips you got to. You know what? You tell the story, because I picked up pieces of information from some of the magical photos and clips you posted. Tell the folks listening, what was it like touring with Willie Nelson and his band?
Okay, so, you know, Kathleen was added to this tour. They call it the Outlaw Music Tour. So Outlaw, I guess, is this brand that they have a Sirius channel, and they have a cruise. And so we had played on the cruise, I guess it was earlier this year or maybe last year. And, I mean, Willie was not on the cruise, but it was, you know, like Lucinda Williams was on it, Steve Earle, like a great lineup of that kind of music. I mean, like Outlaw Country, in essence, is really, you know, you think of Waylon Jennings and like Willie and those guys, but they've sort of expanded the brand to be like other alt country and Americana type artists. So I think that was sort of what what brought Kathleen to their attention was that we were on this cruise and they were able to see, you know, whomever they is, whoever books these things. And they saw the band, and it's been a pretty steady band for a couple of years now. And it's, I think we play really well together, and I have been a fan of hers since before I even played professionally. And so it really is exciting for me to continue to play those songs with her. But so we were added to this tour, and it's like a touring amphitheater situation where, you know, the show starts at 5 o'clock or something, and Willie plays at 9 every night. He plays for 60 exact minutes. He has the same voice, like he's totally with it. And of course, we all had these dreams of like, well, we're going to sit down with Willie. We're going to have a tete-a-tete with Willie. That wasn't really the case. And I should have probably predicted it. You know, he turned 90 this year. He had this massive birthday party, 2-day birthday party in LA. You know, he's elderly, and they were very COVID conscious, which of course makes sense. It was, you know, the rule was, anytime Willie's on the grounds, everybody had to mask up.
Yeah.
And we were allowed to watch his show from side stage, but again, masked. And, you know, he essentially lives on his bus. They pull up the bus to the stairs next to the stage about 10 minutes before his show. They get him up there. He walks out on his own, but he sits now. Mm-hmm. And his son Micah was on the tour as well, playing in his band and also opening every day, playing a Particle Kid set. Particle Yep. Kid is Micah's thing. And I got to know Micah a little bit. I really enjoyed hanging out with him. He's a very affable and easygoing guy for someone who is, you know, the son of an extremely famous person, and who's probably had a lot of interesting experiences. It only occurred to me towards the end of the tour to ask Micah. I was like, wait a minute, you must have known Waylon, like, when you were a kid. And he was like, yeah, you know, the Highwaymen.
Yes, of course.
You know, they toured all over the place, but there was a tour in Australia where everybody brought their families.
Oh.
And Micah, you know, as far as Micah was concerned, he was basically like, Waylon was like my dad's smelly, weird, older friend who I didn't really like. And there was one incident where they had taken them to a playground, and Micah had gotten sort of caught in the monkey bars.
Oh no.
And nobody saw except for Waylon, and Waylon came over to try and help him out of the monkey bars, and Micah was like, don't touch me.
Oh, like, wow.
He didn't want anything to do with him, because he just, I mean, you know, what was Waylon Jennings' disposition in 1986 or 87? He was, you know, he may have been smelly.
Yeah, maybe so. And Micah also plays in Promise of the Real with Neil Young.
That's
so
right.
Interesting pedigree there. Wow.
Yeah, of course. I'll tell you, Government Mule was on several of the dates. And when I was younger, I was a huge fan of that band.
Yeah.
I mean, I still am for sure. But you know, there's like a band that at this point has been around 25 years, and they totally carry the Southern rock torch. And, you know, Warren Haynes, definitely a guitar hero of mine, and was able to sort of meet him and chat with him. Lovely guy, very humble, and they just killed every night.
Nice.
John Fogerty was on several of the dates, and that was incredible.
Oh, wow.
I think he's about the same age as my dad. He's about 77.
Yeah.
And he's just got... he's got all the energy.
Yeah.
Because he only recently reacquired his catalog.
Yes.
You know, he was in this situation where he didn't, I think he could have legally played his own songs, but he wasn't going to be paid for them. So he had severed himself from his catalog of massive hits. And now he's out there playing every one of them. Like, he does 75 minutes and it's just hits. And it was really exciting. He has two of his sons in his band also. And one of them looks like John Fogerty from the Woodstock movie.
Oh, wow.
Like the same haircut and everything. And he's
the bowl
guitar
cut.
Player.
He's got the bowl cut.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
It was just a lovely tour. I mean, a friend of mine, Micah Halscher, who's on my record actually, plays with Margo Price, and Margo's done tons of these Willie dates. And Micah was like, man, it's going to be so relaxed. You're going to hang out in catering all day.
Oh, nice.
You're going to play your 45 minutes or your 60 minutes, and they're going to take care of you. And that's exactly what happened. It was just very easygoing.
Oh.
And then to say nothing of like getting to hear Willie for 60 minutes every night.
Yeah.
And just like a really, like, yeah, there's tons of hits in the set list, but tons of like deep stuff too, deep cuts and like interesting other things that he was playing. It's really, I think there's really few people living who are in that sort of rarefied air of being such an absolute legend. Like, the guy was writing songs when Hank Williams was alive.
Oh, yeah. Like, no,
that's a long time ago.
I love Willie Nelson so much, and I've seen him a couple of times now. And, you know, albums like Phases and Stages just still haunt me. You know, I just I think he's the best. Now, did you end up, I know you had to be side stage and masked during his sets, but did you not end up on stage at one point with him?
I did. So at the end of his set every night, it was sort of floated around backstage. Somebody mentioned, if you're side stage when Willie's playing, you're welcome to come out and sing the, not the encore, but the last song.
Oh, wow.
It's going to, yeah, it's going to be, I Saw the Light, and then they go into, Oh Lord, It's Hard to Be Humble.
Oh, nice.
And so, yeah, I happened to, one of the shows, my son was with me. My son is, his name's Eli. He's going to be 8 shortly. And he was able to make it down to the Pittsburgh show. He just stuck his thumb out and made it. Made his way
That's a rite of passage for every 8-year-old to hitchhike down to Pittsburgh from Southern Ontario on their own. Yeah,
to see his dad.
Yeah.
So, okay, so interestingly, and understandably, they were trying to limit guests backstage. The same COVID protocol thing. It totally made sense. And I had a little bit of static sort of getting him backstage, you know, him and his mom. And it ended up okay, but I was sort of worried that someone was going to spot us and say, hey, those people aren't supposed to be back here.
Right.
And we're side stage. And this is, you know, I've maybe the 6th or 7th night that I've seen Willie. And Willie's wife watches the show every night from side stage, and with her daughter-in-law, Micah's wife.
Yeah.
And they roll out a little road case for her to sit on and a smaller one to put her feet on. And I didn't, the truth is I didn't really meet her during this tour, but I could see her every night. She turned around and looked at us, and I was like, oh no, we're like, we're done. She sees that there's extra people here, and she's going to ask us to leave. Instead, she came over to Eli and said, can he see okay? And I said, oh yeah, I think he's okay. She says, come here, dear. And brought him over to the road case and sat him on the road case. So he had a great vantage point for the show.
Oh, lovely.
And then, at the end of the show, you know, a couple of the roadies bring out extra mics so that everybody can crowd around them. So I just said, all right, let's go. And I grabbed him by the hand and I pulled him out there.
Wow.
And yeah, we did. I Saw the Light. He was excited. I mean, he knows Willie. He actually, he goes to sleep every night to a curated Willie playlist, a Willie bedtime playlist.
Oh, nice.
I picked sort of the most relaxed Willie numbers that I could.
Oh.
And that's been for years. And so he's aware of Willie Nelson, which is why I really wanted him to see the show. He doesn't really know I Saw the Light, but that's fine. I think he was just in awe of being on the stage and seeing all the people and everything like that. It was a particularly busy show. Yeah, it was great. That is a
total phenomenal. I think that'll stay with you forever. That's amazing. So.
Absolutely.
Wow. Yeah. You know, music's awesome this way. It connects you with your heroes, and it sounds like that's the case. Well, let's get into you and your work, in terms of this band that I must confess I wasn't super familiar with. Aaron, you and I go way back to, times when you were in a band called Huron.
That's right.
Yeah, what did I do? I interviewed you guys, I think, probably, and put on shows. And so I was a big fan of you guys, and that, and it was nice to befriend all of you. Espanola, I'm a little less familiar with. Tell us about band. Where did this project come from?
The truth is, it's a name I've been using since the Huron days. It was like, if I ever had something that I wrote that didn't quite fit with Huron, I just sort of kept it in the Espanola catalog or whatever. I attempted to make an EP years ago, like around the Huron days, and I issued like a couple sort of CD singles or whatever. It wasn't really anything to write home about, because I didn't have a lot of time. I mean, as Huron was ending, I got a big road job with City in Color, and so I left for 2 or 3 years, and it just fizzled. But I always sort of had the name, and I had a catalog of songs. And then, you know, since 2010 or so, I've been very busy on the road, even though that's also the first year I produced a record. It's just, you know, the road has been my living, essentially.
Yeah.
So anytime I tried to dive into this project and like do anything with it, it was sort of like a tour would come up and just, you know, the things get complicated. It's interesting because like I've spent so much time traveling with other people, playing on other people's records, I'm very grateful to be able to do that kind of work. And I've never had to deal with putting something together myself. I a little bit took for granted, I think, that somebody pays for my flights. And so, you know, I send an invoice and I get paid. And like, it's a very, you know, we all know it can be a fickle and difficult business. And so this is the first time where I've really like taken the reins and put a band together. And it's not accurate. You know, when I put out the first Espanola record, I had a bunch of different bands. There's been a different band virtually for every tour that I've done. But so yeah, the first record came out in 2019 and I had made it over the course of like 5 years previous. And really the impetus to finally finish it and put it out in a hurry was I was playing with Future Now, which I still do with Ian Blurton's band. And we were going on a tour and Ian had our first record. The first Future Now record was finished and he wanted to go across the country and he floated the idea. Well, why don't you play an Espanola set and we'll back you for that. And so I decided, well, this record that is very near complete should just come out so that I can take it across the country. So that's what I did. And then this second record, the one that's coming out now, was, you know, comparatively written in a much shorter time and recorded in a very short time, which I was very happy about. It was a different process and I loved it. I gave the reins to another producer entirely, John and Yellow. And I decided from the outset, I have to behave the way I would want my best client to behave, like, you know, in the studio. I have to let John make the calls, and I have to just go with it. I have to release, you know, whatever nonsense I have that, you know, whatever things I'm clinging to, I just got to let it go and just let it happen. And I'm so happy. I'm so proud of the record. And I think like it just went just as well as it could have. I really have John to thank, to be honest. He's so great.
Yeah.
And I thought we worked really well. He was in Toronto working on the last Winter Sleep record, or maybe now it's two records ago.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't even meet him. I was out back of the Rivoli, I think loading in. And he was up with Winter Sleep at the Dream House, which is a studio a couple doors down. And they were out on the rooftop, you know, and they waved down. They said, hi. And I was like, oh, hi. And later Lowell from Winter Sleep told me, you know, you'd probably get along with John. Mm. I think you guys would probably agree on a lot of things. So I gave him a call.
Just like that. And, now, what are some of the things you said, John, you kind of had to let go of your, you know, producer impulses, I think is what you're getting at there, mm-hmm. and give those over to John. What kind of things did John bring to the party for you there in terms of, you know, advice, decisions made that you were like, huh, that I don't know if anything radically changed your vision of what a song could be, but can you think of any instances where John really stepped up and shifted your way of thinking about something?
Yeah, well, you know, first of all, the things that I had to let go of was more my instincts as the songwriter or as the...
oh, I see.
You know, yeah. But also the production thing too. Like, I think we're similar producers in that I don't really aim to really like drastically change anything. I want the... Like if a client comes in to see me, I want to hear the compositions first and I want to know that I like the compositions, that I think that they're worthy of fleshing out. I don't really want to go crazy and, you know, present them in some radically new light or anything like that. I mean, once in a while, it you know, really depends. But, you know, mostly I want to sort of put a song in its best clothes and make sure that it is as accessible as possible. John is the same way, I think. And really what I needed was like his perspective and his approval, I guess. You know, sometimes in the studio, you're so mired with nonsense, with like indecision.
Yeah.
That's a big thing. And the role of the producer is just somebody, you know, the producer has many roles, but one of the roles is sort of, you know, we're going to go this direction and we're just going to do that now.
You know, Aaron, if I may, ask you something, because I think you occupy a really interesting place in this creative process as both a songwriter, a musician, and a producer. And I think, you know, I earlier we were kind of distinguishing between those hats you wear, but is a producer not ostensibly a songwriter, if you will? Like a songwriter, of course, will write the music, hopefully, mostly, and come in with the lyrics and all those sorts of things. That is writing, literally, often a song, if not writing it all down, but mostly composing the thing. And then you bring it to a producer who can contribute so much to the end result that you're like, wait, who wrote the song? I know we've,
right.
There's a history of legal disputes about such things. And
of course,
and you know, production, the credits on an album and the liner notes can be a little nebulous in this regard because producer is overseeing the whole thing. Like that's kind of the, what we understand. Mm-hmm. But given what you do and what you've done and working with someone like John, could you back me up on this, that a producer is ostensibly a songwriter? It's not.
Sure.
Yes. Okay. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's definitely project specific. I would even almost say it could be genre specific because of course you have hip hop and pop where the producer is often the person who like builds the track.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
They might bring a near complete track to a top line writer or to a vocalist or whatever. And then yes, in that case, like, of course, the producer should be afforded all the composition credits. The way I work is I make arrangement changes a lot. That is to say, like, what is this random two bars doing before this bridge needs to go?
Exactly, yeah.
Or, you know, that kind of thing. Or, yeah. Like, this song needs a third verse, go write it. Or forget this third verse, get rid of it. I don't feel that I am due, like, actual compositional credit for that, because really the composition is the melody and the lyric, right? That's sort of the, the general understood thing. Now, if I ever make changes that constitute, you know, that are to those things, if I make a melody change or a lyric change that I think is so influential to the song that it really changed the song, then I'll probably send an email and say, hey, you could cut me in on this one. But I rarely.
Is that ever awkward?
No, I try and be pro about it. And then, you know, we all know how it went in the studio.
All of a sudden, the producer's saying, you know, if you think about it, I altered the arrangement. Well, like, I see what you're saying about melodies and lyrics and stuff, yeah, but like, altering an arrangement is significant, is it not?
It can be. But so, you know, I'm compensated differently for that. Like, when I produce records, you know, there's a fee, and then also there's, you know, points, like the classic producer's points. And those are awarded not on the composition, but on the master. So put it this way, you know, somebody writes a song and I do the arrangement and I think it's really crucial to how this master worked out. Well, I'm afforded a royalty on that master. But then if they take that song and they want to do it on a live album or they want to re-record it or whatever, doesn't really affect me if I'm not producing it, and they're creating a different master entirely, and they may choose to rearrange the song.
I see.
In which case, I have no compensation on there. But like, if I was to write the bridge and write all the lyrics and the melody of the bridge, then they should cut me into the publishing. In which case, no matter the iteration of the song, I would be compensated.
That now, seems
compensation,
obvious.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Compensation is, you know, it's not as though I'm like. You know, it's not like my mailbox is full of royalty checks.
You're not Timbaland per se.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. But that's perfectly fine. Like I feel like I'm good at a certain subset of things and I'm happy to work on those things. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I raise it because it's interesting that Lowell, spotted you and thought you and John would have a lot in common, given I'm sure Lowell knows your history as both. A musician and a producer. So I appreciate that background. I was pondering the tone lyrically of this record. And I'm sorry, maybe we got sidetracked because you were talking about the history of Espanola. And I wonder when you, and it sounds like you tend to it when you can, when other work isn't around, then you dig in. I have a couple of questions along these lines then. Is this album a, let's call it a product of the pandemic, so to speak, because you had time. And secondly, lyrically, I pick up on a lot of like, I'm leaving, or someone's, the narrative voice is often like, I'm splitting or people are splitting or come together, like come with me, like do something, get like galvanization. It's, I feel like it's vaguely protesty as well. I'm sorry to give you a rudimentary reading of it. I'm just picking up on some themes that I find interesting. I guess the overall question is, can you speak to the relationship between Espanola again and this pandemic and this sort of state of things, as it were, from your perspective?
Sure. To be honest, I haven't given it a lot of thought. Like my songwriting process is usually, I think of, you know, little, sorry, I have a siren here.
That's okay. That's the question police. They're like, you rambled on too long there, and you got to tighten it up, sir. And then I'll say, okay, officer. Anyway, sorry to interrupt you there.
That's okay. Yeah, to be honest, I haven't. Okay, I found with my first record that I went back and I looked at, you know, because it was made over 5 years. I looked at especially some of the older songs and I was like, oh man, that's what I was writing about. Like, not to be all whatever, but like, it kind of just comes out on paper. And then later on, it's like, oh, I think this might have been what I had in mind when I was writing this. And so, yeah, I haven't really like reckoned very much with what's on this record. I can tell you that, yeah, when you say protest, certainly Espanola again, like the title track, has some stuff in it about
strikes.
Yeah.
Picket lines and whatnot.
Yeah. I was remembering the train track protest, which had to do with water on the reserves. Right. Mm-hmm. And I just, obviously I am 100% for clean water on reserves. I had remembered, getting a little into the semantics with a couple people, over, you know, what was an effective protest and what would, you know, what would benefit the cause the most. And, you know, I think we've all sort of, I'm not a judgy person, but definitely there's, I had picked up on some maybe sort of more performative type, you know, Instagram warrior type people.
Yes.
That I wasn't, that pleased with. And I think that's where that song came from. Really just like challenging people to sort of take some real action. Now, like, what real action did I take? I sent an email to my MPP, I remember, or to my MP, who at the time was the Minister of Indigenous Affairs, and got no response.
Yeah.
But that's definitely what I was thinking about in terms of that song. It's interesting you pick up on the leaving thing. That might have been a theme in the first record too. And what does that mean? I mean, I guess I do love the road, and I do love going out, and I don't do it as much anymore. But
well, I will say coming and going maybe even more than leaving. There's a lot of travel on this record as it relates, I think, to citizenship, land usage. Like, I do I pick up on that maybe you have written from both a personal perspective but maybe topically and about maybe what's happening. It also feels like very Canadian. I know you're the context of who you are, and I think you and I are aligned in our ways of thinking about the world in so many ways. So other people might see other things here, but just a lot of coming and going and maybe not being particularly not settled is the wrong word, but there's something there. And I feel like you're picking up on a bit of tension among all of us on some level of like, am I in the right place? Like, where should I live? What should I do? Am I happy where I am? It's just a little bit of an undercurrent and sometimes more overt. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to clarify. It's not just leaving. It seems to be moving, coming, going. For sure. Yeah. Does that make sense?
For sure. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm trying to think of when most of this was written, and I guess it would mostly have been in the pandemic. When I wrote the first one, I got into this interesting situation where I was able to visit. I never wanted to be like the guy who went to a cabin and wrote a record, but I was able to go to PEI a couple times and write at this place called The Dunk. It was built by this guy, Hal Mills, who has passed since, unfortunately, but he was just a great dude who was sort of a patron of the arts and who allowed people to write in this cabin on his property. So a lot of the first record got written there, and I liked that sort of isolation. I sort of needed it to quiet my brain. I'm extremely ADD. And so I have all these fragments of songs, but when it comes time to put them together, I kind of need a place to focus. So this time, a friend of mine, allowed me to cabin sit her cabin in Chelsea, outside, well, north of Ottawa. And, same thing was like, it was the pandemic. So it was not like you could really go anywhere. And she had like gone away on a trip or whatever. And I was able to like live in this cabin for a week, or like a cottage sort of thing. The parallel is that both of these places where I wrote had a wood fireplace, and I really liked tending to the fireplace. And the fireplace ended up lyrically in both the records just because it was staring me in the face.
Songs like on the new album, Not Like Dynamite, maybe? Is that one?
Yeah. Or no, the third verse of Espanola again. I know that I'm safe and I'm warm and there's wood on the fire. That's the fire.
Well, and not like dynamite, is if I have this correct. Today is a flaming pile of everything I've done wrong.
Yes,
I figure I'll jump in too, and this is your cue to come along. I want to walk on the embers and coals.
Yeah.
It's not like dynamite, but it sure ain't a stroll. Sorry, there's some fire in here.
Yeah, you're
too.
Right.
There's some elemental stuff, I would say. The sky, like it looked to the, isn't there a song about, what is it called here? Something about the sky. I thought there was one about that
too. Look to the sky. Yeah, yeah.
Look to the sky. So there's some elemental, I just feel like there's a sense of place that you're wrestling with, whether you were conscious of it or not, that I think as a, you know, settler, you have to start thinking about these things. And so on the one hand, you have overt songs like the one we were just talking about, Espanola Again. But I feel like there is this current of, should we be where we are? You know, questioning where we are and the space we use, and whether there should be gratitude there and reconciliation as well. Truth and reconciliation, if I may invoke that phrase.
Absolutely, yeah.
Is that possible? Is that possible?
For sure.
Yeah, yeah.
For sure it is. I'll tell you something else. Without wanting to comment specifically on it, it's, you know, it's interesting that we're speaking during this time of the Hamas and Israel war, because, you know, I'm a Jew and was raised in this sort of enclave of like, you know, unconditional support for Israel. And I am to a certain extent still a supporter, but I've definitely like opened my mind a lot to the sort of more humanitarian overview of the whole thing.
Yeah.
And that's a thing that that definitely weighs on my mind too. I mean, there's a song on the record called Promised Land Blues, and to be perfectly honest, I wrote it because I had actually, now that I think of it, I also had another cabin trip. I went to my friend Jonas Bonetta, who performs as Evening Hymns, has this great studio out in rural Ontario, and there's a cabin there for people to stay. I went out there and wrote a little bit, and I had the Obama book, Promised Land, with me. And I was like, maybe in my downtime, I'll do a little bit of reading. I didn't really get into the book. Like, I found it kind of dense and whatever. But looking at the title on the cover, I ended up with the song Promised Land Blues, which didn't mean anything to me at the time. And now when I look at it, I'm like, oh, is this my Israel song? Like, maybe it is. And of course, like, it's a very complicated situation, and I abhor violence, and I abhor the subjugation of anybody. But certainly as a Jewish person, I certainly have feelings about it. And I certainly find myself wrestling with, you know, the way I once felt about it versus the way I feel about it now. And that's something that I have had to process. If there's, you know, that's a big theme in my mind for sure. And especially it's now recurred in the last couple of weeks because of what's going on there.
Yeah. I think we're in a weird stage of history and life and in modern times, I suppose, in terms of whether the actions of the few truly represent the actions of the whole. And, We tend to amplify. Sorry, I'm going to go. I appreciate your reticence in terms of talking about the specific conflict in Gaza and in Israel, but I don't know. We see it everywhere. We see it in all sorts of ways. Like, does the Freedom Convoy really represent all of Canada, or even a very microcosm? Does it? Like, I don't know. Those are the people that made it known who they are. Does any terrorist group that is religiously affiliated mean you have to condemn the entire religion? Like, obviously, I think the answers to some of us are obvious, but that's not how the media tends to view things and guide people in their assessment of what's happening in the world. No, these people are Hindus or Sikhs or Muslims, so let's home in on that as the signifier for what this really represents. Meanwhile, there are maybe hundreds of people like that out of billions of people who would identify as such. So, again, I'm speaking out of turn in terms of this actual horrible conflict That's and fine. The lives lost. But I'm saying I do see, like, I don't know, I have subscriptions to various American and British news sources, and they're talking about MAGA all the time. And I'm like, are these people really? They're a fringe group. Like, it doesn't make me hate all Americans.
No, that would be
it. Makes me dislike those who I think are responsible for bringing this to the fore. But I can't. Sure. I have tons of friends in that country, and they're a lot. We're spiritually and philosophically aligned, so I can't then mm-hmm. just cast off all of them because of this minority group who are causing problems or don't align. Anyway, sorry.
No, of course. That's fine. I think if there's something I've learned more as I grow older, it's that there's many, many more people in the gray area than you expect.
Yeah.
There's very few people who are, you know, who will fully and wholly represent the sort of factions that are purported to be the, you know.
We see it in our elections, like how few people mm-hmm. actually vote among the population. Right. Like, I think very... Yeah, there's just not... I wish there was more engagement generally in these things because I think mm-hmm. the majority of people would then stand up to this fringe group, but there's just a lot of indifference that I've not... In every regard, as we're speaking, mm-hmm. A campus and community radio station in Canada just lost all their funding because of one person I don't know what the actual student population mm-hmm. is of that school, but let's say it's 30,000 or 40,000. 1,700 yeah. people... made this decision happen because they were, they knew about it. Yeah, I mean, it's a whole other story, but that small a group was able to alter that entire community for generations. If they get their way, I believe as we're speaking, they were successful. So if they get rid of that media outlet that serves underrepresented viewpoints and music and all sorts of things, the implications are going to be felt for decades. And forever, like people won't have the experiences that you and I came up with, which
campus are we talking about?
This is in Ottawa, CHUO, I believe. Yeah. Yeah. So I'm just saying that we're just in a weird zone where these fringe groups just seem to have, if not power, they domineer our conversations and they domineer decision making and create problems for the whole. So one little fringe group comes up with a decision, or makes a horrible choice. And that, unfortunately, then casts other sort of similar people in a similar milieu or country or whatever are also have to deal with the consequences of this fringe group's actions. Anyway, I'm really on a run here. I'm sorry. I didn't think we were going to do this, but I feel like...
No, that's fine.
I feel like some of this is swimming around in the conflict I hear in the lyrics on this record.
Absolutely. And I mean... You know, obviously the writing is a few years old at this point, so it's not like I was writing about Gaza at the time, but, we are kind of in that space, like, and we have been for a while, right? Where, it's funny, I was, speaking to someone last night about like, where did this all begin? Where did the division truly begin? And I posit that it is, around like RFK.
Yeah.
Like RFK would have been president and changed a lot of things. And because he was assassinated, we got Nixon instead.
Yeah.
And that really set up Reagan, who is trickle down, who is war on drugs, and then really around the first Bush is when the sort of, identity politics stuff started and the real like performative nonsense, you know, and the real like division was really sown in America. I mean, who knows? You could probably point to a million different things.
Yeah.
Things have been tough down there. I don't know if you've heard of the Civil War.
America does lead the way in these, for some reason, in terms of how we conduct ourselves. Listen, I want to get back to this record in the time we have left here because the sound of it is, for those who haven't heard it, it's a very guitar-oriented record. Aaron, I hear you experimenting a little bit with your voice. Sometimes you remind me of Jim James from My Morning Jacket Nashville
that.
Skyline, Bob Dylan sort of stuff. Like you get in that high register, other times you're low. It's a crack group of musicians that have helped you realize this record and some special guests. In a general sense, do you want to say anything about the actual sound of this record? Because for some younger people, perhaps... this might come across as something of an antiquated sound. You know, you mentioned Government Mule and some other, I think, rock-oriented influences you've had in your life. But this seems to be a very true blue expression from you and your heart, what you believe in. But I wonder, I can't help but wonder where you feel like a sound like this fits in sort of contemporary times, if you will.
Sure. Well, yeah, first of all, I'd say... people who haven't heard my records before, they tend to expect a country record from me, which is understandable. I'm best known as a pedal steel player. I love country music so much, and maybe I'll write a country record one day. But you know, you're in a unique position having known Huron. Huron was really a sort of louder, sort of riff type band, and I think our sort of, if we had two influences to pin up on the wall, they would have been Black Sabbath and Big Star.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it was like riffs, but it was also like we really liked writing and we liked melody and power pop and stuff like that. And truthfully, the way I thought of the first Espanola record, and I guess this one by extension, is like it's kind of what I would have written for Huron if Huron had stayed together. It's really, I think, I'm working from the same platform. Like I still love Black Sabbath and I still love Big Star and I love the Allman Brothers and all that stuff. But I also really love like Fats Domino and I really love, I listen to Ray Charles almost every night. Like, he's sort of my guy. Not like this is a Ray Charles record, but, I guess, yeah, when I sit down to play, what comes out of me most naturally and when I'm not thinking too much about it is just like that style of like classic rock kind of guitar playing. And I would loathe to put out a record that was like intellectually dumb in the way that some of that music can be. What I'm trying to do is like bring my sort of, I don't know, my like white liberal academia to a very basic kind of 70s boogie rock structure.
Yeah.
I still, you know, I love Southern rock so much. It's weird. I'm from up here. I'm a Jewish person that's, you know, don't usually like associate my type of guy with, you know, boogie and Southern stuff. But like, that's really something that I gravitated to. I think of this record as my Southern rock record. I think it's the most sort of boogie type record and the most, you know, it's got like grooves on it as opposed to the last one that was more straight. Now, where it fits in like the modern thing, I don't know.
It's a hard question to answer, right?
I tell people all the time when they come in, you know, people who for whom I'm making records, I tell them, you know, the marketing of music is not my business and it's not yours. It's, you know, fingers crossed that a label wants to put something out for you. They can handle how to market it. And I truly believe that we are in this, we're in the most broad time in terms of finding an audience. Like, it doesn't really matter what it is you're doing. If you're doing it well, then hopefully you'll end up on the right playlists of other similar stuff. Yeah. And I'm positive that there's like people making all kinds of different music that are hopefully reaching their people through this like incredible dichotomy of streaming where like, you know, I think that the, you know, as a user of streaming platforms, I think that they can be amazing. And of course, as a creator, I'm dismayed at the payout, but
yeah,
I think ultimately, you know, for fans, it is really positive. It's like the best DJ that you could ever have. Like the algorithm has brought me stuff that I never would have heard otherwise. Stuff that I love. So yeah, I think it's just like, I tried to make them. I also tell people you got to go and make your most honest record because people can tell that about you, whether you think that or not. They can hear whether you're doing something that's true to you or whether it's some weird facade. Yeah. And so I was just like, you know, in this context, like I'm not being paid to do this. I'm paying for it. So I might as well do exactly what I want. And, I definitely see a country record in the future.
Oh,
I don't know how authentic or how old school it might be, but like, you know, something like that I think would be cool. I mean, I definitely love the genre so much. But I still, you know, when you think of the rest of my touring life, it's mostly on pedal steel. I'm playing a lot of like folk rock, country rock, you know, that kind of stuff. So this is my chance to like turn up and bring me back to that side of things that I really love. And I think like it's a thing that I kind of do well, honestly.
Yeah.
I appreciate having the chance to do it here and there.
Yeah. Well, it's a cool record, and I've always been a fan of your playing and your writing, and so it's nice to hear this this again. I'm sorry, I missed out on Espanola, I guess. And
Nice
to catch.
It was a very under the radar thing. Like the last record, you know, I put it out myself and whatever. Yeah. I have to say, I'm so happy to have connected with Sonic Onion. They're Hamilton based, and so it feels right for me because of the time I spent there. Yeah. And they've helped me to push this record a little farther, which I really appreciate.
Nice. Well, speaking of which, yeah, where can people go to learn more about this Espanola record and your own exploits if you want them to keep track of such things?
I've been encouraged for a long time to put together a website, an internet destination.
Oh, I've heard of those.
Yeah. I've not yet successfully done that, but I'm on all the socials. You know, there's both Aaron Goldstein and Espanola on Facebook and on Instagram. Instagram is really my daily. That's where all the stuff goes out. You can, well, first of all, the record is on all the platforms, but if you want to order an LP, they're on the Sonic Onion site. Anyway, yeah, so the Sonic Onion website is where the LPs are. I'm mostly Instagram is the place. That's where all the info is.
Okay.
There'll be a website one of these days. The truth is the studio has I've been lucky to maintain it as like a word of mouth thing. But it does deserve a little website with like some pictures and stuff like that. So I think I'll probably do a combination where you can look at the website, look at all my production work, look at Espanola, and, you know, have all that in one spot. But that's to be determined.
I see. So if people want to pursue you both as a musician and as a producer, best to contact you on maybe a social media platform at this point?
Yeah. Okay. Instagram, pretty much. Okay. And you know, people can reach me that way too. Like there's, you know, click the old email button. That's how you reach me.
Okay. And have you begun, I know the Espanola stuff is a little bit catch as catch can in between your other work and assignments and those sorts of things. Have you thought about working on new stuff for this band?
Oh yeah. The other night I was looking through my voice notes, and I figure I have fragments of most of the next record. It's just they have to be fleshed out.
And is this a country record, as you were just alluding to, perhaps?
No, it's sort of more of the same.
Okay.
Like, rock and roll.
Okay.
I think a country record will come.
Okay.
I just I might have to move to the country first. I'm not sure. But no, there are fragments, there's riffs, there's lyrics. I'm contemplating I took a bit of a foray into co-writing the past few years, which I had never really done before. And I always sort of wondered if that was like a good way to come up with material.
Yeah.
And I decided that it's really case specific. Like I'm sure there's a lot of co-writes that are silly and that are, you know, have too many cooks. But if I sit down with the right person, I think, you know, sometimes the right thing can come of it. I co-wrote a few songs with Eamon McGrath, who's a buddy of mine. And one, Eamon and I and Mariel Buckley, which I'm really happy with. And I'm not sure if that'll come onto the record or not.
Huh.
And I've chatted with like some peers who I really respect who want to come and, you know, who've seen a picture of like this room and they want to come hang and play guitar in this room. And that's great. You know, so you never know if the next record might not be entirely my own compositions, but I think that would be cool. I think collaboration, the right kind of collaboration, can be really effective and great.
Well, that's cool to hear. I will say, you said that in order to make your country record, you might move to the country. That's not necessary. You don't have to, if you want to make an electronic music record, Aaron, you don't have to move into your computer. You know what I'm saying? Like, you don't have to go to the place. I'm going to move. You know what I mean? I'm just making jokes, but no, that's good.
No, you're right. You're right. I got a lot of country music in my brain and I should probably just harvest it. That's the truth.
Harvest. There it is again. Neil Young, Ben Keith. We did it again. If we can go out on a song from Espanola again, I wonder if you can choose one for us and tell us why it came to mind.
Well, you know, the focus track is supposed to be the title track, which is a good number, but I think I want to go with Promised Land Blues. Lately, it's just, I don't know. I'm very proud of it. It's the most like, you know, groovy thing I think I've done. Like it makes you bob your head, which is, you know, there's a really good harmonica solo. I've been accused of, not accused, but I've had it mentioned that it's like, oh, is this like your blues song? Is this a blues? Is this your, you know, have you been listening to Blues Traveler? And my friend Steve Mariner plays the harp on it. And he actually, when I took over the studio, I learned that he lives around the corner. And so and he's a professional harmonicist, among other things.
Oh.
And so he just sort of waltzed in one day and cut this solo. It's really good. And then he just was on his way. It was as quick as that. So, yeah. I'm really happy with I'm really happy with how this song is turning out in the show, because it becomes sort of just a smorgasbord of guitar solos, which is great.
Oh, nice. All right, well, let's hear it right now. This is Promised Land Blues from the new album Espanola, again by the band Espanola. Aaron, this was a fun chat for me. I hope you enjoyed yourself, and I want to thank you for
absolutely
making time,
Vish.
And I hope we speak again, and best of luck in the future.
Of course. Thank you, Vish. It was great to talk to you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promoting for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
It's very nice to catch up with my old friend Aaron Goldstein. I don't think Aaron's ever been on this show. I mean, I can't keep track anymore. We're well over 800 episodes. He might have been on several times. It's a bit of a blur. No, he's actually very memorable. I would remember that. And I'm darn certain he hasn't been on this show, but we have talked in the past. Anyway, Aaron, thank you so much for appearing on this, the 823rd episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and is available everywhere you get your podcasts. If you can find an episode that you're looking for, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my monthly newsletter, please visit vishkana.com. And also like Creative Control or follow it on various social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, what else is there? Blue Sky. I have a Linktree thing in the podcast description, so if you want to engage with me on most things, I should update it slightly. But yeah, anyway, I'm on most of those things, so yeah, please check out my Linktree. How about that? Also, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to keep this show running. I'm at a tipping point of some kind. I want to actually focus in on making the show make some money, so that it's at least paying me a part-time wage, set a goal that I'm going to. I want to get us up to at least $3,000 a month. And as I'm speaking to you, it's not even at $1,000 a month. But if it's not time, I think it's time. 10 years in, I got to do something. So if you've thought about it and haven't yet donated to the Patreon, please do. I've upped the perks at the $10 USD per month tier. And so if you can, again, visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to read more about that and support this show. I'd like to keep doing it and have it be the main thing I do. And I have made time for it, but just a little tired. I'll explain this all in an upcoming dedicated episode to this whole situation, I think. I haven't quite articulated it yet, but nonetheless, please support the show if you can. Thank you. Thank you very much. Speaking of thanks, I want to thank Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario, for their in-kind support for this show. I also want to thank Jim Guthrie. Jim writes amazing songs, and he has loaned me a couple of them to use every once in a while on the show. You can learn more about Jim at jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you so much for listening to this episode featuring Aaron from Espanola. If you enjoyed our conversation and you haven't heard Espanola, I encourage you to check out the new record and their music generally. And if you're very familiar with Aaron and less familiar with me, I hope you'll subscribe to this podcast or follow it and tell your friends about it and spread the word. All right, I will talk to you very soon. I hope you're well. Bye for now.
Softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more.
and is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.